My guest today, Grant Smith, is familiar to Takes on the World listeners as the go-to person when it comes to examining the network of organizations that make up the Israel lobby and their modus operandi in maintaining influence over Congress, its most important occupied territory. As director of the Washington-based IRMEP, the Institute for Research Middle East Policy, he has written a number of key books on the topic, including two histories of AIPAC, America's Defense Line, the Justice Department's battle to register the Israel lobby as agents of a foreign government, and Foreign Agent, AIPAC from the 1963 Fulbright hearings, 2005 espionage scandal, as well as Divert, about Israel's theft of nuclear-enriched uranium, spy trade that deals with U.S.-Israel Free Trade Agreement, and his latest, Big Israel, How Israel's Lobby Moves America, published last year, that provides key details about the extraordinary network of organizations that make up the pro-Israel lobby. On that note, I'd like to welcome Grant Smith once again to Takes on the World.
Hey, Jeff, thanks a lot for having me on again.
Well, great to have you here. When we last spoke in November, after Trump's victory, and what might be in store for the U.S.-Israel relationship, and what effects it might have on the power and influence of the lobby. Well, now we're 120 days into his presidency, and he's trying, and his trips to Saudi Arabia and Israel. What changes do you see, if any?
Well, I think that maybe we understated the Trump's affinity with the Israeli government. Just to elaborate a little bit more on what you were talking about in your analysis of the two speeches, you know, his bottom line statement there was, quote, my administration will always stand with Israel, unquote. That doesn't leave a lot of room for any sort of real advancements in resolving the Israel-Palestine issue. The thought of Abbas as a legitimate representative of Palestinians, which he also advanced, you know, essentially a modern version of the Indian Imperial Police, as you know, mostly stated, an unelected, unrepresentative government, and this idea always of shared values. There's no basis for believing there are really shared values between Israel and the United States, yet that's always part. So, you know, his speech in Israel at the Israeli Museum on May 23rd, I think, should be a red alert for people who were looking to see something different, something positive. It does not look like there's any possibility for even-handedness.
Well, I remember some people really excited when early on Trump talked about even-handedness, but then he finally got the word about what his line had to be. And so we see he surrounded himself with the most pro-Israel core of supporters. I mean, in which you see a member of Chabad, ultra-right-wing religious group, is his son-in-law.
Right. You saw funding for Israeli settlements on the part of his ambassador. I mean, you couldn't have people who are more Israel lobby products. I think, as Hanan Ashrawi said at the National Press Club on March 24, you have settlers occupying the White House now. So it's essentially, there is no daylight between this administration and the Netanyahu government, for sure.
It's interesting. Some of the Jewish organizations are complaining because they don't have the kind of same kind of access they did to previous administrations. They're kind of being kind of blocked out by Kushner,
right,
David Friedman, and Joshua Greenblatt. Like, there's this old expression, core Jews. Kissinger was considered the classic one. But Kushner is over there with no experience as a diplomat, talking to representatives of other countries as if he has some experience. Yet this man was a major, was on the board of the Friends of Israel Defense Forces until he was brought into the White House. It's an extraordinary shift of power, seems, into the White House more than ever was before.
Right. I don't know that there was any need. Traditionally, there's a big confab, as you know, between major Israel lobby organizations and Conference of Presidents of Major American Jewish Organizations, Malcolm Holmline. They all meet at the White House before any trip to Israel and basically try and, you know, control the president.
So let's kind of go back to the beginning here about the effect of the changes in U.S. relations with Israel and the role of the Israel lobby since Trump has become president. What can we expect?
I think it's somewhat redundant at this point, and that's a little bit of what we were talking about. Does Malcolm Hone Line, the head of the Conference of Presidents of Major American Jewish Organizations in AIPAC, do they even need to meet with the Trump administration before it goes to Israel and Saudi Arabia? One could argue, as Malcolm does, that they were cut out and should have been, you know, more able to talk to them before. But on the other hand, what more could they have gotten out of the president? So I think the relationship between the lobby and the Trump administration is that while they may not have any neoconservative hardline, you know, pro-war advisors yet, they certainly are, by all indications from the speech, taking a very strong Israel-friendly line. And basically, you don't hear anything in these speeches that would give any indication, like you did in the Obama-Cairo speech. There's no discussion of human rights. There's no discussion of one state or two states. There's no discussion about elections or democracy. It's basically tilting toward the enfranchised. And so I would say that the lobby at this point is almost superfluous. I mean, it's there. It's going to be in play the closer we get to the elections. But the administration seems to be able to do everything they would want them to do on its own.
Well, it's interesting that Trump talks about making some kind of a deal, and Abbas right. has apparently made certain concessions that the PLO is denying, which are as meaningless as anything else, because the PLO has become a stooge, literally, of the Netanyahu regime. But I've made a point at previous times that the Israel lobby gets its power from maintaining a Israel in a conflict zone in the Middle East that should, for example, be a peace deal in which Israel is no longer perceived as being under threat and therefore no longer needing massive amounts of American weaponry, the Israel lobby would lose its power and would, as an Israeli-American journalist told me years ago or when I asked him the question, it would evaporate. So the Israel lobby has a vested interest in keeping Israel in a conflict situation so as to get more money and weapons for Israel, but also giving them more clout on Capitol Hill. This is why they were not happy with the Camp David agreement, and nor was Israel for that matter. But here was an agreement between Israel and Israel's major enemy, Egypt, and you would think it'd be welcome, but Carter was the only president to get less than 50% of the Jewish vote. This was not considered something that Israel really wanted. They wanted to keep the Sinai in Egypt. They wanted to expand their territory. But most Americans aren't really aware of this, and probably Carter wasn't either.
You see, the Israel in danger framework is a constant in their fundraising appeals. And so I get through other parties, a great number of them. And you're right, it's the main driver, their main empowerment, both in terms of funding and being able to go to Capitol Hill, is to bring an argument to Capitol Hill saying you have to do this because, once again, Israel is in danger. But, again, the argument with the Trump administration, they already seem very much against the JCPOA. They already seem as though they'd like to cancel it, ratchet up tensions with Iran, maybe cancel the deal, possibly, you know, I could foresee them making limited strikes on Iran. If they're already willing to do that, what do you need AIPAC for? What do you need the different cutout organizations that are lobbying for just this sort of thing? So they will be very pleased, and they will. Their coffers certainly will be replenished, and they will claim victory when these things happen. But it won't be clear that it'll be because they scored some major victory. This is already baked into the administration.
Well, it is interesting that Trump has really adopted the neocon line in the Israeli line with Iran, even making the speech, as Robert Fisk pointed out, the day after the Iranians overwhelmingly reelected a moderate who is not actually supported by the Supreme Leader Ali Khamenei, and that I think they're trying to provoke Iran to break the deal or to have some kind of excuse. One interesting thing is that there was a notice in the paper that the Gulf states had made a statement that any kind of gesture by Netanyahu, not any deal, but any kind of gesture to reach out to the Palestinian would be reciprocated by opening among some trade with Israel, but also allowing the Israelis to use their airspace, which they would need if they were to attack Iran by air. And that has not been given much publicity in the mainstream media, but it's quite interesting given the speech that Trump gave in Riyadh and the one again in Israel. Maybe comment on that.
Well, I think one of the biggest things to come out of his May 21 speech in Saudi Arabia is this sense that terrorism is an ideology, that it comes out of certain groups. It's not really a response to anything, particularly anything the U.S. does. And here we are 15 years, a decade and a half after the report on 9/11 identified two major drivers of extremism as being unconditional support for Israel and U.S.-Saudi military ties. He's doubling down. He's basically saying, support Israel, and we're going to make U.S.-Saudi military ties even greater than they were before. And so you have, this beautiful sense of young Muslim boys and girls being able to grow up free from fear and have this pathway to prosperity, as he says. But there is no pathway in Saudi Arabia. There's no pathway in many of these other dictatorships that were present at that meeting either. And so you have this just remarkable blindness and rejection of every hard lesson that's been learned by the United States. The steps that he's taking in both countries, if they don't lead to future major military, major terrorist attacks on the United States, it will be by some miracle. I mean, essentially, there is no step and no statement that he's making, particularly when you compare it to, again, the Cairo speech of Obama, which admitted that the U.S. had, overthrown the Iranian government during the Cold War and that the U.S. hadn't always been a productive force in the region. There's absolutely no recognition of that. So I think both of these speeches should strike fear into the American people.
One might even suggest that Trump isn't even aware of the overthrow of the Mossadegh government in Iran.
Probably not.
I mean, he's shown to be historically challenged. There was a video of when Trump arrives at Israel and he's speaking to Netanyahu and he tells Netanyahu that we've just come back from the Middle East. Israeli Ambassador Rod Dermer sitting there strikes the top of his head and sits back as though, what is Trump going to say next, right? If it wasn't such a tragedy with war looming in the future, it would be a comedy. I mean, I'm wondering how this all is going to impact on the efforts in Washington to bring him down over his business contacts with the Russians or those of his friends, because obviously Russia is a capitalist state now, and Trump and his family have had business connections there, which had nothing to do with the U.S. election. But it's interesting to see. Do you have any sense of what Trump has to do and what impact his relations with Israel will have on how he's treated on Capitol Hill, but particularly by the Democrats?
Well, I think the first step they should take is if they actually manage to get Joe Lieberman to become the next FBI director, he should make a very serious speech at the next American-Israel Public Affairs Committee meeting in Washington.
Today, Lieberman has pulled out. Or been pulled out.
Okay,
fortunately.
Well, at any rate, my vision would be that someone like that would make a very serious speech about the importance of enforcing the Foreign Agents Registration Act at AIPAC, and that he would be applauded. And as we've been talking about through email, there's a great series at Consortium News about the utter
imbalance in reporting on foreign agent activity in the United States political system, where Russia is kind of a small player. Israel's probably the biggest player, but certainly you've got, you know, Saudi Arabia, you've got other countries, Turkey, playing major roles in this sort of thing that has never attracted any attention by the Democratic Party or the Republicans, and that's because politicians find it incredibly difficult to investigate major funding sources.
I remember years ago they had something called Abscam, in which they framed a number of U.S. politicians in a sting operation to make it, in which they were accused of taking quote unquote Arab money. I guess the Israel scab is off the table.
It wouldn't have been politically possible to do that sort of sting operation. It's just in law enforcement, the lesson has already been learned, and it's probably one reason that in 2012 the Directorate of National Intelligence, which was formed after 2004 when the CIA was kind of removed from that role, has now no longer even publishes the counterintelligence report to Congress, talking about Israeli industrial espionage. You know, they've really, you can really see the results of Israel lobby desires not to have that sort of thing be so prominent in terms of reports to Congress. But the American people have no idea anymore how blatant the industrial espionage is, because the key report that used to be used by all the mainstream media is no longer even published. So we can get back to the other Israel lobby programs that we'll probably see implemented, such as the visa waiver, such as moving the embassy, which, again, some of the Israel lobby organizations want that to be done quietly and then just suddenly announce, U.S. recognition of a unified Jerusalem. You know, there's a real push to replace the United Nations as any sort of center of legitimacy in terms of international affairs and just have the U.S. do it directly. Again, U.S. military attacks on the Syrian government. AIPAC has been lobbying for that for a long time. It's finally taking off under very dubious pretexts, which I believe you had a show on some of the very dubious nature of the claims about Syrian gas attacks. Canceling the JCPOA, increased secrecy, no acknowledgement of Israel's nuclear weapons. I mean, Obama wasn't any better on that. He talked about nuclear weapons in Cairo, but then pivoted directly to talking about Iran. So the Israel lobby objectives, aid, prioritizing aid, you know, all of this is moving forward very quickly under the Trump administration, which on May 5th passed $3.7 billion worth of aid for Israel as part of this omnibus bill to keep the government running until October.
Yes, and transferring, as it would be, money from America's poor to not Israel and to the arms industry, there's going to be a lot of questions raised in Congress about some of the other appropriations, but there'll be none raised about the amount of money to Israel. I'm surprised he didn't actually increase the amount to Israel, but he might yet still.
It is. You never know. I mean, there could be any number of things that could happen in the region that would cause them to basically tear up the caps on aid and to start delivering a whole lot more, which brings the question that you raise about Congress. You know, why aren't there any members of Congress who have questioned this? I think it's clear now, finally, Jeff, that the reason there's not any really truly America-centric view on this is that the amount of money to start a campaign for Congress has risen so high, and that local elections like that are essentially needing national election campaign cash. All of these people really have to put in that pledge to AIPAC as a first step to tapping their donor network, and most of them do. So there's that stunning video by Stephanie Sirach when she was a campaign fundraiser, which is on the Internet, making that case. I mean, you just don't have anybody left in Congress that's willing to do anything about this. And so that's why we get all of these I would call it fake news, but fake issues about pointing fingers at foreign influence when they're all awash in this campaign cash that's predicated upon advancing Israel.
Well, one of the most interesting phenomena was, as I mentioned in a previous program, was that for the first time, as far as I'm aware, that the AIPAC was able to get all 100 senators to put, not vote for appropriation for Israel, but actually put their name, their signatures, on a letter to the Secretary General of the UN calling for them, the UN and its agencies, to go light on Israel just at the time when they're expanding settlements and so on. But in the last signatures of that letter, Dianne Feinstein, for example, very rarely has signed AIPAC letters in the past. And she was the one who, a couple of years ago, back when the Democrats and AIPAC were pushing for a major resolution against Iran, Feinstein went on the floor of the Senate and said, "We approve this resolution. It's like a declaration of war against Iran." And she actually stopped the flow of Democrats to sign this letter, which I talked about on the program. It was very important. When Feinstein is forced to sign a letter, and Bernie Sanders, who didn't usually sign any letters, signed it, and even Rand Paul, they must have really used their levers, AIPAC, to get 100 signatures on this letter.
Yeah, I suspect that if we did a poll on that, basically phrased around, you know, the UN issued mild criticism about Israeli settlements and the U.S. did fail to abstain. Do you support or do you oppose that? I suspect that a majority of Americans would say, no, I actually support that. You know, they support not moving the embassy to Jerusalem from Tel Aviv because it contravenes UN resolutions and nobody else has done it. So, you know, I suspect that this is one more case where the members of Congress are way out of step with the people they claim to represent. Either that or they really don't represent them anymore. And I think that's probably more likely.
Well, they represent who pays for them. You've actually taken a number of polls to measure America's feelings. You recently took a poll which asked Americans what countries were liable to get the U.S. embroiled in another major war. And the answers were quite interesting. So tell us about that.
Yeah, let me tell you about that. But first, yeah. Let me just go back.
Sure.
We did actually take a poll on that same question about the UN. And here the question was, a December 23 UN Security Council resolution stated Israeli settlements in the West Bank and East Jerusalem are illegal. The U.S. abstained, allowing it to pass. Do you think the U.S. did the wrong thing? You think they did the right thing? And the majority of Americans thought that the United States had, in fact, done the right thing. I'm trying to pull the poll up right now. But we did have a public opinion poll that had 1,000 recipients. It was statistically significant. And the majority of Americans felt that that was the correct decision. So, out of step with how Americans feel. So, but getting along, we did a survey. It was worded as follows. It asked Americans, again, another 1,000 people, which of the following U.S. allies do you believe is most likely to embroil the U.S. in an unnecessary, protected, and costly war? 36% said South Korea. 28.5% said Israel, and then all of the rest were single digits for Japan, UK, Germany, France, et cetera. So a really strong sense among the American public that the U.S. has a dangerous ally. Now, you and I probably wouldn't call it an ally since it's a one-way relationship, but that's the way it's portrayed in the media. That's the way you have to poll it. So 28.5% think Israel is most likely. Where was this reported? A couple of Iranian newspapers, but nowhere else in the U.S. media. So the poll is very interesting. It's gotten a lot of traffic on Twitter, not so much across the people you think are really interested in putting out polling results, especially free ones.
Well, Grant Smith, you have gotten so much information, important information, from declassified documents from the U.S. government. You've put them out in press releases, and it really seems that the press, it goes out of its way to protect Israel. I mean, you have a case in court, which you've been pursuing, that indicates by legislation introduced by American hero astronaut Glenn and John Glenn and Stuart Symington in 1971, which would have prevented the U.S. from giving aid to Israel because of its illegal nuclear weapons program. And yet that's been proceeding in the courts, and there's not a word in the mainstream media.
That particular case really takes the government to task. It's a lawsuit against the president and all of his major agencies, and that case is going to be, you know, a year old in August. It's already at the appeals court level right now, but it's essentially saying that a U.S. legislative rule issued by the Department of Energy, which forbids any agency, employer, or contractor from mentioning that Israel has nuclear weapons, which is established fact at this point, and the fact that that overrules freedom of information, it's attacking that law. And essentially, we've asked the three-panel set of judges at the appeals court to take the logical steps, rule that that is illegal and unlawful because of the way it was implemented secretly in 2012 by the Obama administration, and then realizing that its sole purpose is to allow the president and his agencies to disperse foreign aid to an illegitimate recipient to actually block the aid as well. You can't really challenge the gag order, which makes all of this possible, without, you know, following the string of evidence and the chain of causation all the way to the aid. So that's exciting. The courtroom action has been incredible. The perfidy of the Justice Department in defending the administration has been absolutely incredible. But there has been no recent coverage of that courtroom action.
Your website and the books you've written paint an extraordinary picture of a country under occupation, of a government under occupation. There used to be this kind of thing, right-wing thing of ZOG, Zionist Occupied Government, but they didn't have any, for the wrong reasons, but you have actually documented facts and figures and historical events, which unfortunately even those, the alternative media, goes along with the mainstream media ignoring, except for antiwar.com and occasionally some other websites. Foreign Agents Registration Act issue, most people are not familiar with President Kennedy's efforts to get the daddy of AIPAC, the American Zionist Council, to register as a foreign agent, and Senator Fulbright, the very famous American senator who called hearings, and it cost him his job in the Senate because he was targeted by AIPAC. It's extraordinary. It's like having a fifth column in this country that goes after politicians who expose it, and now there are none. Yeah. None. Zero.
Right. No, none, zero, and it probably cost Fulbright any chance of being Secretary of State as well. But yeah, that is the power of the lobby, almost exclusively negative. You look at public opinion polls, most Americans don't approve of any of their programs whatsoever. Yet because of their role in campaign finance, you find that they have bypassed democracy by getting Congress, most particularly, to follow their line on just, you know, about 99% of what they want to do. Once in a while, there's a stumble and something that they're going after. It takes a few more years to accomplish. But it is an amazing story. The mainstream media doesn't see any upside to reporting it. But I think our programs are having an impact, and I think the existence of alternative media, including your show, is spreading the word. Now that alternative media exists, not all of it's good, but there is more coverage of the lobby. There's more coverage of what the weapons are being used for. Public opinion certainly seems to be different, or it could be that the Gallup polls before were so bad and so contrived that when you do an accurate poll, it's surprising and people at least pass it among themselves. But does that mean that this well-heeled interest group is not going to get its demands met during the Trump administration? I mean, it would take a lot more going on than what's going on right now to really push back on this.
I had commented on my previous program that Trump's future may be in the hands of the Israel lobby, in the sense of, or Israel. What I mean, reports were that from Israel that Netanyahu appeared more comfortable with Trump than he has been, even calling him Donald.
Right, right. I heard that as well. And what's not to like? I mean, Trump's principles is that life is combat. It's the law of the jungle. You know, all that matters is winning. And for all the religiosity he was displaying, you know, he was a follower of Norman Vincent Peale. It's all about the size of your prayers and winning. So I can't imagine they're not very much aligned in a way that there's simply no alignment with anyone who's been marginalized or has a just cause.
I want to tell people again about your website, your Israeli Lobby Archives. It's an invaluable resource that needs to be spread and used, because you have put out documents from the government, for example,
right,
which showed that Prime Minister Netanyahu was the receiving end of a smuggling operation of nuclear triggers back in the 80s, run by an Israeli Mossad agent who was a big Hollywood producer who was given a 10-year visa extension by John Kerry. It's like these people have a run of the country without having to worry about any U.S. law.
Right. Well, you know, it's amazing. It could be a Hollywood movie.
Itself,
and someone did,
yes,
make a movie about that. But in the movie, the evil Arabs were the ones smuggling the Krytrons.
Yes.
Not the Israelis. So,
yes.
You know, not even in fantasy can you get any approximation to the truth. But yeah, if people want to go to irnep.org, the surveys are there. Videos from our big annual conferences with the Washington Report on Middle East Affairs are there. The Israel Lobby Archive papers are there. New document releases all the time. Lawsuit updates, et cetera, et cetera. So
get a big pot of coffee. Get a big cup of coffee, a comfortable chair, and sit down and look at irmep.org, Israel Lobby Archive, and you will find out that the day has passed and you will be angry. Anyway, Grant, it's great to have you as a guest again on the program. So take care,
beautiful,
my friend.
Thanks, Jeff.
And keep on the great struggle.
Much alive.
Take care.
Bye-bye. Thanks a lot.
This is Jeff Blankford. Thank you for listening.